All right. Happy Monday, everybody. I got a an email last night from Greg out in California. He's called in quite a bit in the past. Him and Brian, they're the ones that did quite a few shows with me, particularly about the Apollo moon landing hoax. We've talked about other things, but mostly that. Anyway, he sent me an email last night, and I guess Dave McGowan over the weekend really took a turn for the worse. As you may know, he's been struggling with cancer. And it looks like this is, the final leg of his battle, unfortunately. He might actually already have passed away by this point. I don't know. He said he just really, really went downhill. So it's really sad. Dave McGowan, of course, has done a lot of good work with the Apollo hoax, amongst other things. A lot of good work with, CIA involvement with, the Laurel Canyon fiasco, all the strange Hollywood deaths over the years, on and on. I first became aware of him quite a few years ago, probably 15 years ago, with a book he wrote called, gee, what was the name of it now? It was kind of like a, I think it was called Derailing Democracy or something like that. I can't remember now. But it was kind of a handy little reference book detailing all the fiascos that our wonderful government has pulled over the years, domestically and abroad. Anyway, it's really sad to see him going downhill like that. I was supposed to have him on. I think it was back on Oracle. Supposed to have him on as a guest, and it's really sad how it turned out. I had forgotten that I scheduled him for that day, and so I got off on a rant, and then I didn't even check the screen for the call. I just totally spaced it off, totally forgot. I think I booked it several days in advance, and forgot to put a sticky note on my computer screen or whatever. Anyway, I got an email from him later. What happened? I heard you talking. You never, picked up the phone. I felt horrible. I guess he waited there for like 20 minutes or something, and that was pretty bad on my part. But anyway, so after that, I was, I didn't want to ask him to come on again. Felt terrible for doing that to the poor guy. And now it looks like I'm probably never going to get to interview him. It's really sad. But Greg said he might actually call in this morning at some point. I'll have to watch for his phone call here. Don't see him calling in as yet, so. All right. We have, as our usual, listener that calls in to listen. So in the meantime, I'll pick up where we left off on Friday with the Iron Mountain thing. We're almost done, actually, with these notes, just a couple more pages. But very revealing. When you look at documents like this, wow, it really tells you how these bastards operate, how they think. And once again, notice how they discredit the thing by stating it was a hoax. And by doing that, automatically, it gets most people either to not look at it, or if they should look at it, they won't take it serious because it's been labeled a hoax by officialdom. Or if you try to point their attention to it,
They're going to say, oh, that figure's typical conspiracy nut. Don't you know that's been shown to be a, you know, it's just, again, like the protocols. Like the protocols. Exact same thing. Protocols are, you know, 101% accurate blueprint that you will order, but because they've been labeled a hoax. And once again, all you have to do is ask these idiots, have you ever read the thing? That's all you got to do is read it. Just read it, you stupid ignoramus. And of course, they're going to answer no. And so then you have justification for slapping them upside the head and saying, how can you condemn the thing when you haven't even read it? Oh, how many times I've seen that over the years. About many things I've discussed with people, you know, including my heresy book on the Trinity, you know. Have you ever read it? Oh, your theory is ridiculous. Have you ever read it? It's not a theory. Have you ever read it? Of course not. I'm not going to read that. Then you have no grounds for condemning it, so shut up. Wow, wow, wow. Of course, you know, it wouldn't matter anyway. Wouldn't matter anyway, even if they did read it. When people read something with a closed mind, you know, it could be a German shepherd biting them right in the throat, and they still wouldn't see it. They'd be in denial. What German shepherd? I don't see it. What are you talking about? As it's tearing into their jugulars. You know, that's just how stupid people are. Oh, it wouldn't even matter anyway. Anyway, picking up where I left off on Friday, the document then goes on to discuss the development of blood games. It actually uses that term, blood games, to effectively control individual aggressive impulses. To be realistic, a ritual of this type might be socialized, like the Spanish Inquisition, and the witch trials of other periods. This is, you know, what this was one of the main functions of MKUltra, to find out how to silence individuals, not just to control the public mind, but to silence individuals that could affect the public mind. The purposes would be for, quote, social purification and state security, says this document. And how often have we heard that trump card used, especially in the courtroom? Your Honor, this is a matter of national security. Oh, well, why didn't you say so? Okay. And that's the end of that. Out the window would go any attempt now to bring any evidence. Oh, nope, nope, can't allow it, can't allow it, can't allow it, can't allow it. The national security trump card. Jesus Christ, man. Anyway, the document went on to say it is considerable less fanciful than the wishful notion of many peace planners that a lasting condition of peace can be brought about without the most painstaking examination of every possible surrogate for the essential functions of war. Only psychopaths could have drafted up a document like this, folks. Anyway, then it goes on to talk about the ecological factor. And I think this is the final. Nope, there's one more, actually. Under ecological, it talks about how this function of war is put in such a way that is particularly degrading to man. It starts out in paragraph one with man, like all other animals. All other animals. Well, that would include you bastards that wrote the damn thing, wouldn't it? Anyway.
So, you know, the document brings man, and of course, the authors obviously aren't considering themselves to be in that category somehow. To be calling man an animal, you might replace that word animal with beasts, or better yet, cattle, or perhaps goyim. Who could have written something like that, ladies and gentlemen? They go on to comment that, quote, to forestall the inevitable historical cycles of inadequate food supply, post-Neolithic man destroys surplus members of his own species by organized warfare. They're talking about their own selves here, admitting that they do this. You know, to forestall the inevitable historical cycles of inadequate food supply, talking about, again, the overpopulation BS. We have to cull the herd. But it gets even crazier in paragraph 2, where man is compared, quote, in a limited degree with rats. This is because they kill their own kind. Obviously, again, they're referring to themselves here. So is this an admission that they're a bunch of frickin' rats? One of the functions of war, they state, has, quote, served to help assure the survival of the human species. Oh, yeah, there's some Orwellian doublespeak for you. War ensures the survival of the human species. Let me state once again, folks, it's this is so disgusting, man. This planet could support a population 10 times its current size with no worries. There are plenty of resources on this planet. Don't forget, governments around the world, you control governments around the world for decades on end, have been ordering farmers to destroy millions, yea, billions of tons of perfectly edible produce just to keep the prices artificially high for the scum on frickin' Wall Street. There's no shortage of food. There's certainly no shortage of oil. And we don't even need to depend on oil, God damn it. There's no shortage of any resource. It's all bull crap. They simply want a small population because it's easier to control a smaller population, which is why you got those goddamn Georgia Guidestones talking about reducing the population down to 500 million. Holy Christ. They go on to say that in nature, it is the fittest that survive, but the inferior disappear. So there's your frickin' Darwinian philosophy at play there. Survival of the fittest. How interesting that they draw this analogy from nature. But they don't mention that there's no analogy in nature to compare with a human system where elite trash suck off of the labor of others to support their war machine. They don't talk about that. They don't talk about how in nature elite groups actually stage wars to cull the herd. They don't talk about that. They don't talk about how in nature you don't have a system where the elite amongst the beasts rig their societies so that all, the acorns, for example, are stored up in the hands of a few and depriving everybody else of acorns when there's plenty of abundance to go around for everybody. No, you don't see those things in nature. They create the weak, ladies and gentlemen. They create them to be weak. Unnecessarily. And then they turn around and have the gall to use the analogy that, you know, this is how nature plays out. The strong dominate over the inferior, the more fit. They consider themselves more fit because they have no goddamn scruples, no human decency. They're liars and frickin' thieves that belong behind bars. Let's talk about what happens in nature to animals that try to steal from other animals. They kill them, ladies and gentlemen. So if they want to use the nature analogy, they should be dead, shouldn't they? In paragraph 6, they state, conventional methods of warfare would almost surely prove inadequate in this event to reduce the consuming population to a level consistent with survival of the species. In other words, war doesn't kill enough people. This was in the wake of goddamn World War II that killed, you know, how many hundreds of millions? It's just not adequate enough because they want billions to be killed. Holy frickin' Christ, man. Since war has shortcomings as a way for selective population control, it generates a lot of fat wads of cash for us, so we still like it, but it doesn't kill enough people, they're saying. They believe coming up with substitutes for this function, quote, should be comparatively simple. Yeah, just like Bertrand Russell said a few years earlier in his Impact of Science on Society, that we need to introduce a black every so often, every generation or so, and that could keep the population down adequately enough. They suggest that to be, quote, a universal requirement for procreation to be limited to artificial insemination. There you go. Conception and embryonic growth would thus take place under laboratory conditions. This type of reproductive system would have the advantage of being susceptible of direct eugenic management. That's a direct quote from the document. Direct eugenic management. So, sterilizing the masses or outlawing procreation. In other words, if you get pregnant, you better kill your baby or we're going to kill it for you. Or we might even kill you for getting pregnant when we told you not to. Other than that, we will select who gets pregnant and we'll do so in the laboratory. This is where we're heading, guys. This is the kind of world they want and the kind of world they're going to have, obviously, before very long, because we have a dumbass, mindless, might as well be products of incest public mindset that just doesn't want to see what's right in front of them, biting them in the throat. The last section talks about cultural and the cultural and scientific aspect. They said that culture, as a function of war, can, in the form of art, show, quote, the exaltation of bravery, the willingness to kill and risk death in tribal warfare. So, you know, use art or video games, for example, or movies. That's probably the kind of art they were talking about there, because you see it so blazingly portrayed, don't you, in movies glorifying warfare. Instilling the kill mentality. Look how much money the Pentagon has invested in creating war-themed video games. Get young teenagers all pumped up with that idea. So once they're out of frickin' school, oh, they got the recruits right there, not only on the college campuses, but on high school campuses. Let's see if we can get them before they even go to college. Or, you know, we'll find the ones that feel they can't afford college. We deliberately drove up the price of tuition for that reason, or that's one of the reasons anyway. The function of war concerning science, the document went on to say, is a different story since war
is what motivates the development of science on all levels, and unfortunately, isn't that true? All the great scientific developments came about through, military research, so that all these other applications of technology are secondary. The real reason for the advancement of science, the reason why so much money is pumped into it, is because of the warfare applications. We'll only let a few things squeak out to the public. Jesus Christ, everything is for the purpose of destruction, not bettering human life. I was just corresponding yesterday with this longtime listener, and she brought that very point out. And I've said that myself many times over the years. This world could, should, and would be a relative paradise, ladies and gentlemen, compared to what it is today. Can you imagine? With all the brilliant minds out there working in labs, developing new technologies. Can you imagine if all those efforts, or for that matter, any of them, were being put or allowed to be put toward bettering human life, extending the human lifespan, developing the most advanced, natural supplements that could meet all of our needs. I was talking with a friend the other day. If they wanted to, they could have they could have made like a Star Trek type device that you could just pass over your arm every morning. You wouldn't even have to use a needle. I mean, they can take your they can test your blood sugar level, folks, now without a needle. If they can do that, they can do this too. You pass it over your arm, it'll read your blood chemistry and could tell you exactly what nutrients you need for that day. Then it could make a recommendation of what types of foods, what fruits, what vegetables, what nuts, what grains that would be best suited to make up for any lack of nutrients, in your blood. They could have such a thing. That would alleviate 99.9% of all the diseases out there, the ailments out there. Why isn't science developing something like that? They could, but there's no money in that. The whole medical establishment would go belly up. Do you see my point? If it wasn't for the tribal greed factor controlling everything, look what a world we could be living in, should be living in, would be living in. That's only one thing. But what a difference that would make. You wouldn't have outrageous goddamn grocery bills, would you? Over the top frickin' college tuition bills, would you? You wouldn't be paying an arm and a leg and an arm and a leg of your spouse and your neighbor and your kids and your grandfather to buy a goddamn house, would you? You wouldn't have to donate your testicles to buy a car now, would you? Or your ovaries. Look how outrageously priced everything is. Look how they make everything into a massive, lucrative, money-draining frickin' enterprise for everything you do in life. Even down to buying a goddamn car now. Cars were never, affordable. But they certainly were a hell of a lot more affordable in previous decades, weren't they? I mean, they weren't ever something you could just go out and buy outright with the spare change in your pocket or even what you had in your bank account. Nobody really is. I mean, the masses, the swelling masses have never been able to buy a goddamn car with spare cash they had on hand. Almost without exception, they've always had to take a loan, but they were always much more easily affordable. Didn't break the bank today. Today, for an economy car today, ladies and gentlemen, you are paying at least $10,000 more than what you paid for a house just 30, 35 years ago. Think about that for a minute. Jeez, goddamn Christ, man.
Oh, the things you put up with, America. Oh, not just America. Oh, when you stop and think about how they have frigged us over, that's upsetting enough. But project forward and look where we're going. Look how worse things are going to be. You know they're going to be worse in coming years. And there's only one reason for it. Only one reason. It doesn't need to be this way. We, again, guys, we could be living in a paradise. We shouldn't have to be working even 10 hours a week. Never mind 30 or 40, which again, most people, can't even get a job that with those many hours anymore. But you shouldn't have to work that many hours. With all the advancements of technology, with machines doing the work that most people used to do, you should be able to get a job working only 10 hours a week and paying a decent, livable wage. They did it 30, 40 years ago, ladies and gentlemen. One person in the household working was enough to pay for the entire household. Everybody lived comfortably. All the bills could be paid. They were all within that one person's income's reach. And that was a period where companies weren't making anywhere near the massive amount of money they're making today. There's no need of any of this. Anyway, the document ends off by saying, in science, a substitution for the function of war could take the form of a, quote, giant space research program. This is one of the things they proposed to drain the public dry and fatten the wallets of the bastards at the top. Just have a giant space research program. Hell, we don't even have to actually be doing anything in space. We just have to tell them that's what we're doing, and that can justify draining their pockets dry. Well, that's pretty much what happened just a few years later, isn't it, with the Apollo missions. Huge price tag, and yet what really happened? They set a studio up with some small, 4 or 5 inch tall models. Probably cost $99.95. Jesus Christ, man. Where did that money go? Well, while you're contemplating that question, you might want to ask yourself where any of your money goes. Where did the missing $2.3 trillion go in the Pentagon that Rumsfeld talked about? To this day, no accounting has ever been given, or ever will, because, of course, the section of the Pentagon that housed all the documents that could have told where that money went got destroyed when it was hit by Flight 77. Notice how this whole document, that's all they're concerned about, is controlling the population and justifying sucking money out of your pocket. That's their concern. That's a Jew concern, ladies and gentlemen, isn't it? Isn't it? The thing has tribe written all over it. Anyway, it's been a while since I've engaged in my favorite activity of Bible bashing. So I thought we were a little overdue for that. So, put this set of notes together recently. Most of the quotes in this, not only Bible quotes, but I got a lot of extra biblical quotes in this study as well. Most of them, there's some new ones too, but most of these I've already read on previous shows. However, not in this context. I've discussed this theme before, but I never put a whole show together, including all of these quotes together. So the theme isn't new, but the presentation, the way it's presented is new. I thought it'd be good to do a show on pointing out where, since we're talking about the New World Order, the agenda behind, the Iron Mountain document. That's all that damn thing was about. I thought it'd be appropriate to show where ultimately the goal of the New World Order really came from. Once again, so many people would have you believe that, those that actually admit that it's a Jew agenda, would have you believe that, oh, well, it comes from the Kabbalah, or it comes from the Talmud, blah, 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 blah. Oh, that goal is mentioned in there, no question about it. But once again, guys, it dates back long before that. The Jew World Order agenda originated in that goddamnable, detestable piece of toilet paper book called the Bible. That's where it comes from. And, if you had any doubt prior to this time, well, sit back and strap yourself in for a rough ride. This set of notes here, for those of you who have requested Bible exposure notes of the past that I've done, this set here you got to have. This set here you got to have, because I've gone through and collected every possible verse I could conjure up. There's probably more that I missed, but this is the most complete collection yet I've put together of all the verses in that damnable collection of crap that talk about Jew World Order. And let me tell you, they are legion. There's a huge amount, and they are so in your face, disgusting. So if you want grounds for condemning this book, this is it right here. Anybody who's even mildly aware of this goal for world domination, they might not be Jew-wise, but they do recognize that this agenda is in place. The Alex Jones crowd, for example. Show them this. Shove this right in their face. Okay, you admit that there's a conspiracy for world government. Great. But guess who's behind it? Guess what document we have in our possession that goes back at least 2,500 years that set this whole thing in motion? Anyway, whose system is this global system that's emerging? Throughout history, we find that this goal has always been the plan of our little tribal friends. They themselves have attested to that fact. But how did this whole idea get started? Well, we answer that question. Let's first look at some admissions by our little tribal friends over the years that this has indeed long been their aim. It's perhaps appropriate to look at what the protocols has to say on this matter to begin this discussion. Look at this quote from this fraudulent document. It says, "The Goyim will be compelled to offer us international power of a nature that by its position will enable us without any violence gradually to absorb all the state forces of the world and to form a super government," which of course is happening right before your very eyes through things like the UN that they created. It goes on to say, "Place of the rulers of today, we shall set up a bogey which will be called the Super Government Administration. Its hands will reach out in all directions like claws, and its organization will be of such colossal dimensions that it cannot fail to subdue all the nations of the world." We're pretty much there now, aren't we? They've got the EU, several other similar regional unions. They've got, of course, the UN. They've got the World Trade Organization that overrides and supersedes national sovereignties. Anyway, let's look at some more quotes from tribe members over the years. This next one here. Comes from Dr. David Wolfsum, who headed up the Zionist movement in the wake of Theodore Herzl's death. He gave the opening and closing speeches at the 8th Zionist Congress at The Hague in 1907, at which time he instructed his fellow tribe members to set aside their differences and unite to, quote, conquer the world. He was quoted in the New York Times as having said that August 22nd, 1907, in an article called Says Jews Must Conquer, Dr. Wolfson Delivers Closing Speech at Zionist Congress. The Jews must unite to conquer the world. So, that goal was in place at least in 1907, of course. If you recognize the protocols as a legitimate document, and it certainly is, it goes back even 2 years before that when it was publicly released in 1905. So it's at least that old, isn't it? 1922, in a Zionist gathering at Carlsbad, California, Nahum Sokolow gloated that, quote, Jerusalem someday will become the capital of the world's peace. This was from an article called Says Jews of World Will Back League of Nations. Dr. Sokolow tells Zionist Congress Jerusalem will be international peace capital. New York Times article, August 28, 1922. In the 1879 book Conquest of Germanism by Judaism by Wilhelm Marr, we read, oh, so this goal goes back now at least 1879, doesn't it? This is before the modern era, the modernized movement called Zionism. It's been around a hell of a lot longer than that. But some people think that this whole thing started just with Theodore Herzl. Oh, Christ. Whatever, man. Here's what that book said. The advent of Jewish imperialism is only a question of time. The empire of the world belongs to the Jews. Vel victus. Woe to the conquered, it says. The Kabbalah, meanwhile, states, oh, this is going back quite a few decades before that. It says, Rabbi Jehuda said to him, Rabbi Cheskiah, he is to be praised who was able to free himself from the enemies of Israel, and the just are much to be praised who get free from them and fight against them. Rabbi Cheskiah asked, how must we fight against them? Rabbi Jehuda said, by wise counsel thou shalt war against them. Quoting from Proverbs 24:6. By what kind of war? By deceit and trickery whenever possible. Oh, well, isn't that interesting? So here we have the motto of the Mossad, isn't it? By means of war, thou shalt, by means of deception, thou shalt wage war. They're quoting here from the Talmud, aren't they? Or the Kabbalah, which itself is quoting from the book of Proverbs. By what kind of war? By deceit and trickery, it says, whenever possible. They must be fought against, the Goyim, without ceasing until proper order be restored. New world order! Thus it is with satisfaction that I say we should free ourselves from them and rule over them. So there you go. Clearly laid out in the Kabbalah, ladies and gentlemen, which dates back, it was committed to paper or parchment in the 5th century, but it's acknowledged to date back at least 1,000 years prior to that time, to the Babylonian captivity, which is the same time the Bible dates back to, if not before. The Kabbalah, you know, again, goes back to at least that time. Most likely the Bible, probably the whole damn thing, or at least a very good portion of it, was created at that time. But some of it dates back earlier, at least tradition-wise. Some of it was oral tradition. Certainly, you know, things like the Book of Job dates back probably much earlier than that period. Job lived somewhere in the Fertile Crescent, and yet he talks about, you know, frozen lakes existing. That has to be, you know, early post-Ice Age kind of crap. And that was known to have been a document that was handed down from early on. But again, most of the rest of it is just, it was just emerged. It was just invented in the, oh, by the way, when I say Ice Age, there were multiple Ice Ages, as I pointed out when I talked about the, Earth catastrophism and whatnot. When I say Ice Age, I'm not talking 10,000 years ago. The name Yahweh didn't even exist back then. I'm talking about one of the, you know, the later post, little mini post-Ice Age periods, but still long preceding the 5th century B.C. Anyway, the Zohar, Toldoth Noah 63b, states, "The Feast of Tabernacles is the period when Israel triumphs over the other peoples of the world. That is why during this feast we seize the lulav and carry it as a trophy to show that we have conquered all the other people." So there you have this goal of world domination portrayed there as well. In the February 9, 1883 edition of Jewish World, we read, "The great ideal of Judaism is that the whole world shall be imbued with Jewish teachings, and that in a universal brotherhood of nations, a greater Judaism, in fact, all the separate races and religions shall disappear." David Ben-Gurion, in the December 16th, 1949 edition of Jewish Chronicle, was quoted as saying, "Jerusalem aspires to become the spiritual center of the world." When you have all these quotes in front of you, ladies and gentlemen, it's impossible for anybody to deny that there is, in fact, a conspiracy on the part of this tribe for world domination. But wait till we get to the quotes from the Torah. Ben-Gurion was also quoted in the January 16, 1962 edition of Look magazine as saying, quote, "In Jerusalem, the United Nations, a truly United Nations, will build a shrine of the prophets to serve the federated union of all continents. This will be the seat of the Supreme Court of mankind to settle all controversies among the federated continents." Whose goal is it? Dominate the world? Well, you don't have to read these quotes. Just tune into Alex Jones' show and he'll tell you. Dr. Nahum Goldman, former president of the World Jewish Congress, speaking in Montreal in 1963, quoted in Le Unite National, French publication, number 4, 1963, proclaimed, quote, "The Jews might have had Uganda, Madagascar, and other places for the establishment of a Jewish fatherland, but they want absolutely nothing except Palestine, because Palestine is the crossroads of Europe, Asia, and Africa, because Palestine constitutes the veritable center of world political, the strategic center for world control." World control. You see why they wanted that little strip of real estate, ladies and gentlemen? That's why they wanted it. Not because of any resources it had. No, they get other nations to steal those resources for them. They wanted it because it is a very, and always has been, a very strategic area. That's it. Strategic for domination of not only that region, but ultimately the world. Rabbi Meir Kahane was quoted by the Jewish press November 9, 1973, as saying, "The Jewish people cannot ever be destroyed, but rather they and their God of history will emerge in days to come triumphant over the evils and foolishness foolishness of all other nations. Zion will and must emerge as the mount to which all other peoples turn. And we can do it because we have the stolen cash from everybody's pocket to buy everybody off. So we get what we want. Buy everybody off in positions of power that aren't already part of their little tribe, that is. In a letter written to Karl Marx by Baruch Levy, reprinted in the Rothschild publication La Revue de Paris, or de Paris, June 1st, 1928 edition, page 572, we read, "The Jewish people as a whole will be its own Messiah. It'll obtain world dominion by the dissolution of other races, by the abolition of frontiers, by the annihilation of monarchy, and by the establishment of a world in which the Jews will everywhere exercise the privilege of citizenship. In this new world order," it actually says new world order, folks. "In this new world order, the children of Israel will furnish all the leaders without encountering opposition." Wow. "The governments of the different peoples forming the world republic will fall without difficulty into the hands of the Jews. It'll then be possible for the Jewish rulers to abolish private property and everywhere to make use of the resources of the state. Thus, promise of the Talmud be fulfilled, in which it is said that when the Messianic time has come, the Jews will have all the property of the whole world in their hands." Why, looky there. And they have pursued this goal tenaciously, relentlessly, haven't they? Marx, Horkheimer, a Marxist Jew of the Frankfurt School, stated, quote, "The revolution won't happen with guns. Rather, it'll happen incrementally, year by year, generation by generation. We will gradually infiltrate their educational institutions and their political offices, transforming them slowly into Marxist entities as we move toward universal egalitarianism." God damn it, guys. "We will infiltrate there," meaning the Goyim, "gradually infiltrate their education institutions and their political offices."
Well, I'm glad that hasn't happened here.
The American Hebrew, September 8th, 1920 edition, declared, quote, "The Bolshevik Revolution in Russia was the work of Jewish brains, of Jewish dissatisfaction, of Jewish planning, whose goal is to create a new order in the world. What was performed in so excellent a way in Russia, thanks to Jewish brains and because of Jewish dissatisfaction and by Jewish planning, shall also, through the same Jewish mental and physical forces, become a reality all over the world." Proud of the despicable, despotic outbreak of tyranny in Russia in 1917, and they want to carry it out, and indeed have been carrying it out, all over the world. In his 1924 book, You Gentiles, Maurice Samuel wrote, "The Jews are the destroyers and will ever remain the destroyers. Nothing you can do will meet our demands and needs. We will forever destroy because we want a world of our own." So, clearly, the tribe has long had a not-so-secret agenda in place for world domination. But this agenda is, once again, not new. As we've already seen from some of these quotes, they date back at least to the 5th century in written form, and 1,000 years prior to that in the, you know, in the form of oral tradition. But ultimately, even older than the Talmud and the Kabbalah and the Zohar,
Where ultimately can this thing be traced? Well, first, let's look at how this is, in fact, a historical goal. It's been admitted that it is a historical goal, and it doesn't just get traced back, 100 years ago to the time of Herzl. Max Mandelstam, speaking at the World Zionist Congress in July of 1898, stated, "The Jews energetically reject the idea of fusion with the other nationalities and cling firmly to their historic hope of world empire." So when he stated this in 1898, he said it was their historic goal, a very old historic goal. Rabbi Harry Waiton, in his 1939 book, A Program for the Jews and an Answer to All Anti-Semites, A Program for Humanity, he wrote, quote, "The Jews are the highest and most cultured people on earth and have a right to subordinate to themselves the rest of mankind and to be the masters over the whole earth. This is the historic destiny of the Jews," he said. "Judaism is communism, internationalism. It is with these spiritual weapons that the Jews will conquer the world and the human race." Unfrickin' believable. With all of that in mind now, let's take a very close look at this damnable, detestable book. Do you see why I tell you to hold on to your old family Bible as backup toilet paper? Do you see why I tell you it's not enough to say I don't believe in it? You have to recognize it for what it is. It is pure, unadulterated evil. I don't call it the 2,500-year-old protocols of the learned elders of Zion for nothing, ladies and gentlemen, because that is exactly what it is. It is the original, the oldest that we know of anyway, blueprint, the New World Order. Let's take a look. Some of these quotes I've read before, but some of these are new. Nevertheless, when you look at them all together, there's no getting around it. We'll start with Psalm 47:4. He, Yahweh, shall subdue the under us, the Jews, and the nations under our feet. All the arrogant quotes that we just read from stem from this book, ladies and gentlemen. This historic goal we just heard about, they readily admit, they have had this historic goal in place for a long time, but it doesn't originate, as the Bible dupes would have you believe, from the Talmud or the frickin' the Kabbalah or the Zohar. Oh, no. It goes back even before that. But it doesn't really matter. Let's say they can prove that the traditions of the Zohar date back before the Bible. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. The holy book that you like to hold up so high and lofty as being so pure and unadulterated and so loving and wonderful, and actually try to give the impression that that book is against the idea of the New World Order. Well, guess again. Guess again. Isaiah 45:14 says, "And they, the Goyim, shall be thine, Israel's. They shall come after thee in chains. They shall come over, and they shall fall down unto thee." In other words, on their knees and bow before you. Isaiah 49:23, "They shall bow down to thee with their face toward the earth and lick up the dust of thy feet." Isaiah 60:12, "For the nation and kingdom that will not serve thee shall perish. Yea, those nations shall be utterly wasted." You know, one of the Ben-Gurion quotes made reference, he's talking about the goal of Jewish world domination. He actually said, in accordance with the prophet Isaiah, as the prophet Isaiah had foreseen, he's talking about passages like this, folks, where the nations are going to bow and lick the dust of thy feet. The nation shall be utterly wasted. They shall perish, those who will not serve thee. It was passages like this he was referring to. Deuteronomy 28:1 says, "The Lord thy God shall set thee on high above all nations of the earth." Here's another one, Jeremiah 1:10. "See, I, Yahweh, have this day set thee over the nations to root out, to pull down, and to destroy." To root out, to pull down, and to destroy. Well, they've been doing just that, haven't they? Have you checked out Germany lately? Look at the havoc they've wreaked in Greece. Look what they're doing here. Never mind. You don't have to look abroad. God damn it. Look what they're doing to all European countries right now. Through the wonderful EU that they created. Look at the frickin' mass influx of goddamn illegals over there, just like we have here. Look what's happening, folks. Decimation, the destruction of cultures, of civilizations, of nations, of national sovereignty, of national currencies. Oh, they're all out the window, aren't they? With the euro. And why is this happening? In fulfillment of prophecies like this, to root out, to pull down, and to destroy. Where did this idea come from? Where did this concept originate? From that God damnable, only good for toilet paper book called the Bible. I hope you don't buy the bull in the Bible. Isaiah 60:16 says, "You, tribe members, shall also suck the milk of the Gentiles and shall suck the breast of kings." Holy Christ. There's nothing holy about Christ, by the way. Isaiah 61:5 says, "Strangers shall stand up and feed your flocks, and the sons of the alien shall be plowmen and your wine dressers." Isaiah 60, verse 5. That was 61:5. Isaiah 65 says, "Then you will look and be radiant. Your heart will throb and swell with joy. The wealth on the seas will be brought to you. To you, the riches of the nations will come." Look what has driven their psychopathic, endless, relentless lust for power and wealth down through the centuries. Look where it comes from, guys. No other book so glaringly and blatantly portrays this agenda. Isaiah 61:6 says, "And you will be called priests of the Lord. You will be named ministers of our God. You will feed on the wealth of nations, and in their riches you will boast." Genesis 27:29, "Nations shall serve you, and kingdoms shall bow down to you." Gee, frickin'. Genesis 12:3, "And I will bless them that bless you, and curse them that curse you, and in thee shall all nations of the earth be blessed." Do you feel blessed, ladies and gentlemen? This was what the great Yahya said to Abraham. Deuteronomy 7, verse 6 says, "For thou art an holy people unto the Lord thy God. The Lord thy God hath chosen thee to be a special people unto himself above all people that are upon the face of the earth." This is the same psychopathic deity, by the way, who said he doesn't play favorites. Isaiah 10:14, "As one reaches into a nest, so my," Yahweh's hand, "reached for the wealth of the nations. As men gather abandoned eggs, so I gathered all the countries." So here's Yahweh saying, "I am the one who reached into the nest and robbed them for you. I'm the one that enabled you to do this." Like I said, guys, if there is an entity
an actual entity called Yahweh. The damn thing is as evil as you can get. Do you understand? That's the best you could hope for. Obviously, this damn thing, like everything else, is a lie, was invented. But even for those who insist, oh, no, no, he's real. Okay, he's real, but he's evil. So what the hell are you doing worshiping him then, you stupid asses? After reading these quotes, or after showing these quotes to somebody else, if they can't see what the hell is going on here, share your stories. Let me know. Request these notes. Share them with your friendly neighborhood Bible dupe, who won't be friendly to you after you share these notes, probably. But anyway, let me hear what they have to say. I'd be very curious. I'll call in. I'd love to hear the kind of responses you get. I can pretty much predict them, but Isaiah 14, 24 to 27 says, "The Lord Almighty has sworn, surely as I have planned, so it will be, and as I have purposed, so it will happen. I will crush the Assyrian in my hand. On my mountains I will trample him down. His yoke will be taken from my people, and his burden removed from their shoulders. This is the plan determined for the whole world. This is the hand stretched out over all nations. For the Lord Almighty has purposed, and who can thwart him? His hand is stretched out, and who can turn it back?" Did you catch that? First he says, "I will crush the Assyrian in my hand. On my mountains I will trample him down. His yoke will be taken from my people, and his burden removed from their shoulders." I don't care about anybody else being yoked and burdened. I don't want anybody else yoking and burdening my people. "I will take their yoke and their burden from them. And this will be the plan determined for the whole world," says Yahya, who believe in Yahya. Yahya has come through with his promise, hasn't he? And you claim to be against the freaking Jew world order. You claim to be against this emerging system of global domination, and yet you embrace this Fargan piece of crap book that lays the foundation for the whole goddamnable, detestable frickin' thing? Are you serious now? Psalm 110:2. "The Lord will extend the Jews, mighty scepter from Zion. You will rule in the midst of your enemies." Psalm 110:6. Do you see, guys, how this is all over the Fargan place? This agenda is everywhere in the Old Testament. It's all over the goddamn, but it's in the New Testament too, but not so glaringly as in the Old. They had to do a little facelift job with the New Testament slightly. But look at this. It's all over the damn place. There's another one, Psalm 110:6. "He will judge nations, heaping up the dead and crushing the rulers of the whole earth." Psalm 72:8 and 9. "And may he, Yahweh, reign from sea to sea, from sea to shining sea, and from the river to the ends of the earth. May nobles kneel before him, and may his enemies lick the dust." There's that saying again. It's used also in Isaiah. Psalm 99, 1-3 says, "The Lord reigns. Let the nations tremble. He sits enthroned between the cherubim. Let the earth shake. Great is the Lord in Zion. He is exalted over all the nations. Let them praise your great and awesome name. He is holy." Well, Bible dupes, I hope you're praising his name now as you warmly embrace the New World Order. You shouldn't be fighting against it, you damn fools. The great Yahya is behind it. You should warmly embrace it. You should be glad that you're losing your job and your home and your kids can't afford to go to school. You can't even buy a goddamn new car anymore. Your food prices going through the roof, on and on and on. You should be glad. This is what your great Yahya has always wanted. Psalm 22, 28, and 29 says, all the ends of the earth shall remember and return to the Lord, and all the families of the nations shall prostrate themselves before you. This is Yahweh talking to Israel. For the kingship is the Lord's, and he rules over the nations. Psalm 2, verse 8 says, request of me, Yahweh, and I will make nations your inheritance, and the ends of the earth your possession. Now, Christians claim that this is a passage that, that refers to Christ. This is supposed to be Dada Yahweh talking to Junior Boy Jesus. But the reality is, it's Yahweh talking to Israel. But it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. All you have to do is look at all these other passages. Who is Yahweh promising to give the nations to in all these other passages? Israel. So here it is here once again. They will be your inheritance. The ends of the earth will be your possession. Deuteronomy 7, 22 to 24 says, and the Lord your God will drive out those nations from before you, little by little. You will not be able to destroy them quickly, lest the beasts of the field outnumber you. It's talking here, ladies and gentlemen, about the Goyim. It's talking about Gentiles. Here, Yahweh is calling them the beasts of the field. You won't be able to do it all at once because the beasts of the field, the Goyim, the cattle, will outnumber you and overpower you. You have to do it little by little, it's saying. And that's just what they've done over the centuries, isn't it? Little by little, one nation at a time. But the Lord your God will deliver them to you, and he will confound them with great confusion until they are destroyed. Holy Jesus, frickin' Christ, man. Did you catch that? I could elaborate for the rest of the show just on that last frickin' statement. The Lord your God will deliver you, will deliver them to you, and he will confound them with great confusion until they are destroyed. According to this passage, all of the propaganda in the Jew-controlled media is the mastermind creation of Yahweh. He says he's going to help them to confound them with confusion until they are destroyed. Oh, they're confounded with confusion, all right. Oh, are they ever? According to this passage, the great Yahya is behind it. So what are you goddamn ignoramus fool Gentiles doing worshiping this thing? What the hell is the matter with you? And he will deliver their kings into your hand, and you will destroy their name from beneath the heavens. No man will be able to stand up before you until you have destroyed them. Holy frickin' Christ. There isn't anything the likes of this anywhere in the Talmud or in the Kabbalah. Nothing, nothing that comes anywhere close to this. Oh, this goal is mentioned therein. You shall wage war by means of deception. But not this brazen, not this detailed, not this frequent. This book far, far outweighs, far outdoes anything of this nature mentioned in those other books. And yet, again, Bible dupes, the few that can acknowledge that the New World Order is, in fact, a Jew World Order, the most you'll get out of them is, oh, yeah. Well, it does date back before Herzl. Yeah, it goes back to the Talmud and the. Oh, no. It goes back before that, much more blatantly so in this damn book. How? How? Once again, the question begs an answer. How can anybody out there call themselves Jew wise and yet embrace this goddamnably detestable piece of frickin' Shiite? Deuteronomy 6, 10, and 11 says, and it will be when the Lord your God brings you to the land that he swore to your fathers,
to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob, to give you great and good cities that you did not build, and houses full of all good things that you did not fill, and hewn cisterns that you did not hew, vineyards and olive trees that you did not plant, and you will eat and be satisfied. In other words, you're going to steal things that you didn't work to create. They're all going to become yours. Do you see how they do this without a conscience, ladies and gentlemen? And you see why I say I don't buy the idea that there are, you know, atheist Jews. I really don't. I'm sure there are some that really are. But for the most part, especially when we talk about the elite ones, they're not atheists. They're following this book to a T. This is where the whole damn thing started. And they're doing what they're doing on behalf of their frickin' tribal deity. Or they know that the whole damn thing was invented, but it doesn't matter. They're still following it. This is still their blueprint. Deuteronomy 2:25 says, "Today I will begin to put the dread of you and the fear of you upon the nations that are under the entire heaven, who will hear reports of you and shake and be in trepidation because of you." Shake and be in trepidation because of you. Deuteronomy 28:9-10. This is a psychopath deity, ladies and gentlemen. An absolute psychopath. I mean, I've proven that many, many times in the past from other angles, but just on this basis alone, this is a raging psychopath who is all for world totalitarianism. There's no bigger advocate of that than this bastard deity. Deuteronomy 28:9-10 says, "The Lord will establish you as his holy people, as he swore to you, if you observe the commandments of the Lord your God," blah, 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 "and walk in his ways, then all the peoples of the earth will see that the name of the Lord is called upon you, and they will fear you." Daniel 2:44 says, "The God of heaven will set up a kingdom that will never be destroyed, nor will it be left to another people. It will crush all those kingdoms and bring them to an end, but it will itself endure forever." Of course, Bible dupes will say that, "Oh, this is talking about heaven one day." Oh, is it really now? Look at all these other passages. They're not talking about some future kingdom in glory land. They're talking about here. Deuteronomy 15:6 says, "For the Lord thy God blessed thee, and he promised thee, and thou shalt lend unto many nations, but thou shalt not borrow. And thou shalt reign over many nations, but they shall not reign over thee." Isaiah 60, verses 3, 13, and 14 says, "And the Gentiles shall come to thy light, and kings to the brightness of thy rising. The glory of Lebanon shall come unto thee, the fir tree, the pine tree, and the box elder together, to beautify the place of my sanctuary. And I will make the place of my feet glorious. The sons also of them that afflicted thee shall come bending unto thee, and all they that despise thee shall bow themselves down at the soles of thy feet. And they shall call thee the city of the Lord, the Zion of the Holy One of Israel." Jesus freaking Christ, man. It just goes on and on. There's no end to these passages. There's another one, Deuteronomy 11:24. "Every place whereupon the soles of your feet shall tread shall be yours," said Moses, "from the wilderness and Lebanon, from the river Euphrates, even unto the uttermost sea shall your coast be." And of course, even Jesus got into the act in Luke 21:24. He says, "Jerusalem will be trampled on by the Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles are fulfilled." What is he talking about here? He's looking forward to a time in the future when the Gentiles won't be ruling anymore. His tribe will again be ruling. That's what he looked forward to. That's what all the so-called messianic claimants of the first century were all about. Can there possibly remain any doubt as to where the goal of Jewish world domination came from? Can there possibly be any way to be genuinely opposed to the Jew world order while yet embracing this abominable, detestable piece of crap literature known as the Bible? Is there any way you can embrace this book, its God, or the abominable religions that have been spawned from it? Judaism, Christianity, Islam. Is there any possible way? No, of course not. You can't deny with your right hand what you're embracing with the left. You just can't do it. Oh, there are many people that are doing that very thing, but you're just making yourself look like a complete brazen frickin' idiot. A fool. A sucker. Take a look at this. Protocol number 14 of the Protocols of Learned Elders of Zion states, when we come into our kingdom, it will be undesirable for us that there should exist any other religion than ours of the one God, whom our destiny is bound up by our position, with whom our destiny is bound up, with our position as the chosen people, and through whom our same destiny is united with the destinies of the world. We must therefore sweep away all other forms of belief. If this gives birth to the atheists whom we see today, it will not, being only a transitional stage, interfere with our views, but will serve as a warning for those generations which will hearken to our preaching of the religion of Moses, that by its stable, thoroughly elaborated system has brought all the peoples of the world into subjection to us. Unbelievable, man. In other words, they're saying, oh, atheism won't get in our way. Eventually, we'll use atheism, as a reason why there's so much trouble in the world. We'll convince them it's because you're not going by our plan of world domination, which Yahweh promised to us. If you go along with it, then we'll have peace, because Yahweh said so. You see what they're saying? So even the atheists can play into our hands. In other words, they're saying that they don't embrace atheism, ladies and gentlemen. They don't. So you have to wonder, they lie about everything else. When they claim that they're atheists, are they really? When they claim they hate Christianity, do they really now? Do they really? Just like when they say they hate Hitler. Again, whether you are a Hitler supporter or a detractor, it doesn't matter. When they say they hate him, no, they don't. They love frickin' Hitler. Look at the mileage they've been getting out of him. They love the guy. Love him. And they love the great Jesus, too. Don't let him kid you. After all, he's one of them, isn't he? Or was. Of course, they love the mileage they've gotten out of him. And, people say, oh, but look how they talked about him in such a derogatory way in the Talmud. Of course, they want you to think they hate him. Of course, some of that might be, some of those sentiments might be genuine. They hate anybody that stands up to their leaders. And the whole Jesus movement, I should say the whole messianic movement of the first century really resulted in the Romans coming in and decimating. And all of those messianic claimants stood up to the Jewish leadership, just like the Essenes did, the Sicarii, on and on it goes, the Zealots. They were all in the same bag, ladies and gentlemen. So there was genuine animosity on the part of the Jewish leaders against those rebels. But look what those rebels wanted. They wanted to rise up and overthrow Rome. And when they realized, okay, we're not going to get what we want, well, we'll just help Rome overthrow this whole system, not cooperating with us. So we'll have them overthrow the whole damn thing and start from scratch. And then we'll just infiltrate the Roman government from within, And that's just what they did. Josephus went to Rome. Remember the whole story.
So there was some genuine animosity against Jesus, but folks, ultimately, they love the guy. Just like Pope Leo X, I got a whole show coming up on him in the not-too-distant future. The tribe member, Leo X, he was a Medici. He's the one who said, what a great service this myth of Christ has been to us. Yes, 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 yes. You need any more proof than that they love the great Jesus? Of course they do. What a great service he has provided for us. We can totally trample underfoot the goyim. And they don't even know it. We can exploit the living Christ out of them, and that's exactly all they've ever done with Christianity. Exploit the ignoramus masses with it. What a great service it has provided. We can bilk them, and they sure do just that, don't they? All Christian cults have bilked their people, but once again, guys, nobody could hold a candle to Rome when it comes to that. Nobody has sucked more people dry than the Church of Rome with its sale of indulgences, for example. Jesus Christ. It still goes on, you know. Oh, they disguise it. They change the name of it from one generation to the next, you know, but from one period to the next, from one country to the next. They're chameleons. You know, they take on the look of wherever they go, you know, blend in, they use the politically correct language, whatever it takes. But today, they still do essentially the same thing. People pay priests to say a mass for their dead loved one, sometimes on a daily basis, sometimes once a week. And do you honestly really think, you know, the average church has hundreds of members, right? Do you really think that a priest, let's say a church has 300 members and on average at least 50 people are paying a priest to do a mass. Do you really think the priest is doing 50 separate masses? Do you think he's even doing one and mentioning all 50 of those names? Are you freaking that stupid? You really think they're doing this? As if it would make a difference anyway. But they do this thinking that it's going to get their dead loved ones out of purgatory. Where do you think the idea of purgatory even comes from? It's not in that goddamn book. There's not even the hint of such a teaching in that book. They invented the Fargan thing so they could bilk more money out of you dumb, gullible saps. Wow. 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 They invented this idea of purgatory, or limbo is another name. Apparently, they're two different places. Limbo and purgatory. But nevertheless, transition periods. Not good enough for heaven, not bad enough for hell. So we'll send them to this transition place, and if enough money is paid to the priest, after a while, the great Yah might open the gate and say, oh, okay, you can go to heaven now. But if not enough money is shelled out to the priest for masses, well, I guess you're screwed, buddy. I'm going to open the gate into hell now and toss you in there. Your relatives just didn't give a damn enough about you to pay enough money to... Jesus Christ! People don't see this for what it is. If you don't hate religion, ladies and gentlemen, especially the Abrahamic ones, it's because you don't understand it. You don't understand just how evil these goddamnably detestable pieces of crap are. You have to hate it. If you hate Jewish supremacism, you have to hate that goddamn book and everything that it has spawned. You have to. Anyway, that completes the first in a series of three sets of notes I'm going to cover between today, tomorrow, probably into Wednesday's show. And then I'll be back off onto other stuff. But once again, regular listeners to this show know that I have to go on Bible bashing rants every so often. You have to, guys. You have to expose this book. And there's plenty in it to expose. Plenty. But once again, this has to be done because, number one, virtually nobody out there is doing this. It's pretty pathetic. Almost nobody is out there talking about this goddamn book. It is the very heart of all the evils we see playing out in our world today. It is. Everything evil going on in this world today at the hand of man is all tending toward that ultimate goal of world dominion. And that goal originated with that freaking book, man. It's the wellspring of the whole goddamn operation. It's the blueprint of it. The original blueprint. So in this next set of notes, let's look at torture in the Bible. Torture has long been a favorite tactic of the world's number one psychopaths, our little tribal friends. They have practiced it themselves or goaded others into adopting it everywhere they have gone. But where did it come from? Where did this idea as far as the tribe is concerned, where did this concept originate from? Where did they get it from? They got it from this book, just like they got their agenda for world domination from this book. Just as the tribe finds justification for killing Palestinians and stealing their land, charging usury to the goyim, you know, on and on and on, so too did they find justification for torture therein, as we can see from the following passages. And they are legion, once again. Proverbs 20, verse 30 says, the blueness of a wound cleanseth away evil. So do stripes the inward parts of the belly. Listen to this. This is torture, ladies and gentlemen. Blueness of a wound cleanses away evil. Beat the person is what it's saying. Deuteronomy 25:2. And it shall be, if the wicked be worthy to be beaten, that the judge shall cause him to lie down and to be beaten. So the great Yahweh, the wonderful, endearing, tender, compassionate, merciful God of love is instructing beating, torturing. Proverbs 18:6, a fool's lips enter into contention, and his mouth calleth for strokes. Listen to the psychopathic mentality here. A fool's lips enter into contention. What does that mean in the tribal context? Someone opening their mouth and exposing their crimes.
Well, we know how to shut him up. He's begging for strokes.
Proverbs 19:29 says, judgments are prepared for scorners and stripes for the back of fools. Whip them. Whip them. A whip for the horse, a bridle for the ass, and a rod for the fool's back. Proverbs 26:3. A rod. Not just a whip now. Bash him with a rod. Crack some ribs for a fool. And notice how it doesn't define what even constitutes a fool here. You can interpret that any way you want. Many people, you know, Protestants and a few Catholics who acknowledge and are in fact even aware of, you know, the Inquisition of the Dark Ages, how millions of people were tortured and ultimately burned at the stake. There are some among them who admit that was a horrible travesty. It should never have happened. Oh, there's plenty of them who will say it was a good thing. A lot of Catholics today and are hoping those good old days come back. But there are some who have the sense enough, the decency enough to admit that their church was horribly wrong in what it did. But by the way, Protestants did it too, but nowhere near on the scale. And, you know, they didn't have the bulk of the kings of Europe behind them doing this. But anyway, what amazes me is the few who admit that this is wrong, they'll say that it's wrong because they weren't following the Bible. Why, the Bible doesn't endorse things like that. The Bible is against those kind of things. Oh, no, 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 no. Oh, contraire.
They were actually following this goddamnably detestable book in doing those things. This book endorses that kind of behavior, ladies and gentlemen. Absolutely. Just like the Crusades. Just like the Crusades. That damnable, detestable book justifies, praises holy wars. Of course it does. They weren't going against this bitch of a book and doing those things. Here's another one. Exodus chapter 21, verses 20 and 21 have this to say. If a man beats his mule or female slave with a rod, and the slave dies. Oh, wait a minute. Excuse me, male. I didn't think that sounded right. Male, not mule. Jesus. God damn. If a man beats his male or female slave with a rod, and the slave dies as a direct result, he must be punished. But he is not to be punished if the slave gets up after a day or two, since the slave is his property. Oh, so you can beat your slave to the point where they're, you know, passed out on the floor, all bruised up and bleeding, broken arms and legs, doesn't matter. But if in a couple of days, after a day or two, if the slave is able to get up, well, then you're exempt. You don't have to be punished. Jesus Christ Almighty. So that leaves the door wide open. All right, just make sure the heart is still beating and make sure the person can get up after a couple of days. If they can't, well, just prop them up, you know, stick a hook in their back, help them stand up. And as long as it looks like they're standing up, even though you're using a hook in their ribs, then you won't have to be punished. Look how that leaves the door wide open. Wide open. To do whatever you want to your slave. The fact that this book even embraces slavery at all is pretty disgusting, isn't it? Yahweh went to all the trouble to flee, to supposedly, you know, according to the fairy tale story, to free his chosen ones from slavery into Egypt. But he has no qualms with the Goyim being enslaved. In fact, he told them to do it, didn't he? Thou mayest enslave a Gentile, but not thy fellow Jew. If you do enslave a fellow Jew, he is to be released upon the seventh Jubilee year. But thou mayest enslave a Gentile for life. He shall be your property. Proverbs 13:24 says, he that spareth his rod hateth his son, but he that loveth him chasteneth him betimes. So here now it's talking about torturing your kid. Beat him. Don't spare the rod. Whack it over his back. Break a few bones if you have to. Chasten thy son while there is hope, and let not thy soul spare his crying. Proverbs 19:18. Again, I'm not against, you know, spanking guys. But that's not what this is talking about. Beat him with a rod. And then the psychopathic mentality here. Make sure he cries. Well, of course, if you spank a kid, he's going to cry anyway. But no, this is a psychopathic mentality here. Let not thy soul spare for his crying. In other words, keep hitting him. Don't stop when he's crying. Get off on it. Jesus Christ. Show no mercy, in other words. That's what it's saying. Torture the kid. After you spank a kid and he's crying, that's when you take the kid, you hug him, and then you tell him, you know, this wasn't easy for me to do, but I had to do it to teach you a lesson. Do you understand why I did it? What you did is wrong. It can hurt you. It can hurt others. It hurts me. And if you do it again, I'm going to have to spank you again. I know you don't want to be spanked again, so I'm sure you're not going to want to do that again. You're going to, you know, take every measure to make sure you don't do it again. But according to this, no, once he's crying, don't
bear spanking him or hitting him with the rod for his crying. Don't stop, it says. Once the kid is crying, you've already got the message across. You don't need to spank him any further. In fact, if you have a conscience, you have love and compassion for your kid, you're not going to be able to spank him any further. It's at that point that you stop and you tell him why you spanked him. But no, this psychopathic son of a blank and blank of a book is telling you don't spare, don't stop, keep spanking or whipping him or whacking him with the rod. Keep that torture going, regardless of the crying, show no mercy. It's telling you to torture your kid, folks. This book is psychopathic through and through and through. Here's another one, Proverbs 22:15. Foolishness is bound in the heart of a child, but the rod of correction shall drive it from him. Wow. Again, there's that word foolishness. Not defined. You can define it any way you want. If you're a psychopathic drunk dad or mother, for that matter, wants to take your frustration out on your kid, you've got full justification here for doing so in the holy book. Torture him. Don't spare for his or her crying. Keep whacking him with that rod. Here's another one. The rod of reproof gives wisdom, but a child left to himself brings his mother to shame. So, again, torture, spank the living Christ out of him. That's Proverbs 29:15. Beat them hard and often. Don't worry about hurting them. You may break a few bones and cause some brain damage, but it isn't going to kill them. It's all for their own good, right? Here's another one, Proverbs 23:13-14. There's no end to this. Just like everywhere you look in that damn book, it embraces world domination. Everywhere you look, it embraces torture. Withhold not correction from the child, for if thou beatest him with the rod, he shall not die. Thou shalt beat him with the rod and shall deliver his soul from hell. Freaking believable. Beat him. Beat him with the rod. Oh, don't worry, he won't die. Oh, crap. I killed him. Oh, the Bible said he wouldn't die. Oh, well, what the hell. I could just make more of those babies. Beat him with a rod. In the context of several parables, Jesus made it clear that he endorsed sinister torture. Here are some examples. And his Lord was wroth and delivered him to the tormentors, Matthew 18:34. And he saith unto him, friend, how comest thou in hither not having a wedding garment? And he was speechless. Then said the king to the servants, bind him hand and foot and take him away and cast him into outer darkness. There shall be weeping and gnashing of teeth, Matthew 21:12-13. Jesus got off on this kind of thing. His parables were loaded with stories like this. He never said it was wrong to do it. He accepted it as the norm. Didn't he say, for those that can withstand it, it's good if you can become a eunuch for the kingdom? Cut off your little danglers. Yeah. The Lord of that servant shall come in a day when he looketh not for him, and in an hour that he is not aware of, and shall cut him asunder and appoint his portion with the hypocrites. Again, there shall be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Matthew 24:50-51. Luke 12:46-48 says, the Lord of that servant will come in a day when he looks not for him, and at an hour when he is not aware, and will cut him asunder, and will appoint him his portion with the unbelievers. And that servant, which knew his Lord's will, and prepared not himself, neither did according to his will, shall be beaten with many stripes. Same mentality we find in the Old Testament, isn't it? Luke 16:22-24 says, and it came to pass,
Oh, and don't say, oh, Jesus isn't saying that he's in favor of that. He's just saying that's what's going to happen. Oh, really? This is the same Jesus who said, bring those before me who won't bow before me as king and kill them in front of me. Remember that one? Anyway, this is Luke 16:22-24. And it came to pass that the beggar died and was carried by the angels into Abraham's bosom. The rich man also died and was buried. And in hell he lift up his eyes, being in torments, and seeth Abraham afar off, and Lazarus in his bosom. And he cried and said, Father Abraham, have mercy on me, and send Lazarus, that he may dip the tip of his finger in water, and cool my tongue, for I am tormented in this flame. Here Jesus is talking about, this is kind of a long story, but I made reference to this before when I talked about the teaching of hell in the Bible. A lot of idiots that embrace the doctrine of hell that isn't even in the Bible. The idea that, you know, if you're a bad boy, you go to a burning place. It's just not there. But some idiots quote this to make it look like the Bible teaches this doctrine. Jesus is actually just playing on a Hellenized belief that had crept into Judaism, in the early, in the first century, that you did go to this bad place of torment. Anyways, he's just making reference to that. But notice in the story, he has the rich man that represents the Pharisees in this case, begging Lazarus, who's gone to the good place, to dip his finger in water and touch his tongue to provide him relief, as if that would give you relief. But nevertheless, the idea here is that if you're a bad boy, you're going to be tortured. That's the idea Jesus gave when he talked about the future burning of the wicked. You know, they'll be weeping and gnashing of teeth, that they're going to be tormented in flames, that it's going to be his dada that does this. His dada is going to torture in flames. So, again, the same mentality you find in the Old Testament, it's here in the New. Here's some more passages that imply Jesus was in favor of torture. Matthew 8:29 says, and behold, they cried out, saying, what have we to do with thee? These are demons that Jesus supposedly was about to cast out, speaking to him. What have we to do with thee, Jesus, thou Son of God? Art thou come hither to torment us before the time? In other words, they knew that a time was coming when Jesus was going to be tormenting them on the day of judgment. But they're asking him, are you coming to torment us before the time? You got to wonder once again, guys, if this is such a loving God, why torment at all? Why not just snap your finger or twitch your eye like Bewitched there and have them be gone? If you're not a psychopath, you're a loving deity, you created these goddamn creatures in the first place. Why even create them in the first place? Why allow them to commit the evil, or why allow your own people to be subjected to them and their evils? Oh, no, nobody asks those questions. Oh, he's going to fix it one day. Why allow it in the first goddamn place? Oh, well, he has to let sin run its course. It's already run its course, according to your ridiculous interpretation of how the world works. Oh, it's this way because of sin. All right, okay, fine. It's been going on for thousands of years now. We get the point. Oh, their explanations for why the world is so screwed up are themselves so frickin' screwed up, man. Anyway, you know what? Looks like we've got a caller here. Let me just read one more passage, and then I'll take this call. I think it's might be Greg calling it. Mark 5:7. It says, Jesus, thou Son of the Most High God, I adjure thee by God that thou torment me not. This was another demon that Jesus was about to, begging Jesus, don't torment me. You know, Jesus was a tormentor, just like his dada. Torturers. Once again, guys, where does torture come from in the modern world? Where has it always come from, ultimately? But in the modern world, the neocons pushing for torture. Where do they get this idea from? The same place they've always gotten it from. This damn book. It's like they got their agenda for world domination from this damn book. Anyway, let's see if this is Greg on the line. Is that you, Greg?
Hey, Charlie, it's Jason Erb.
Oh, Jason, yeah, sorry, man. I didn't recognize the number. What's up?
Yeah, probably best to save talk again of the London 7-7 thing to later, but just heard you talking about the Bible, which one of my favorite topics. Of course, there's some people who you get the emails about saying like, oh, you've beaten it like a dead horse. But the thing is that, like you said, you pretty much are the only one who's covering it from this angle, because there was a guy on GCN, a Voice of Reason, who he was actually a former Satanist. But he came out and said it's all a bunch of nonsense. And he actually had like a lot of the views that you did in terms of conclusions about his study of the Bible for like 30 years. But he was like a Christian, but he had found that there's no hell, eternal conscious torment taught as part of some afterlife in the Bible, and that other things that, you know, he didn't want to openly come out and say it, but essentially it's saying that Jesus is, the whole Son of God thing is just metaphorical, that he wasn't God himself,
right?
And not really some, well, definitely not the begotten Son. And he pointed out the problems with the King James Bible. There's just so many different problems. And you see like how they try to fix it up in the New International Version, for instance. There's that discrepancy between like Paul, whether he like sees a light or hears a voice, and whether he's like going down on the ground when he hears it or sees something. And they go and fix that all up. And there's that big contradiction that you pointed out, which is like apparently right there in the King James Version, they accurately translate that or depict what was in the Hebrew was about saying like, I did not command you concerning sacrifices.
Right? Yeah, and then, right.
And then, but in the New International, in the New International Version, it's completely dishonest about how they change it to say, I did not only instruct.
Oh, right, the word is, that word thing. Is it, right.
Yeah,
right.
So it completely changes it, and they have no...
And I love this, too. Not only is the King James full of crap, there's a lot of, I'm sure, as you know, a lot of people that believe in the King James only. I think it's the best translation. King James was translated, or at least the head translator, was frickin' Francis Bacon, a goddamn Rosicrucian / Freemason, right? But then some will say, oh, no, well, we prefer the New International Version. That's a much better. And, in fact, it's a bigger seller now than the King James. It's the most popular selling Bible. Well, what they fail to recognize is the two translators of that, the ones who put that the whole text together that became the basis for that and so many other modern translations, were Westcott and Hort, which were major followers of Blavatsky, Kabbalists, occultists. Oh, my God, you got to love it, man. People are just idiots.
Yeah, actually, I heard that, was it the guy with Fox there was involved with that? Rupert Murdoch
had
some holdings
yeah.
in Zondervan Publishing.
Yeah,
but of course...
I actually have a show on that sometime that I want to do, though, on... The NIV and the Westcott Hort text. I'll have to get into that sometime.
Yeah, as I was reading someone commenting, like it's about, well, part of it's about making money. Another thing is that, of course, the whole Cyrus Schofield's Bible was all about promoting Zionism. So, like all these Bibles, of course, have their own religious political agenda. It's not just about like having some accurate translation. And the thing is, like for instance, the so-called New King James Version, like the whole thing with hell, for instance, that they got rid of the bogus mistranslations where they're saying it hell when it's like Sheol in the Old Testament, but they're inconsistent.
Yeah.
They actually still retain some references to hell.
Right.
It's completely inconsistent. Like you got to look to Young's translation; it's pretty good. Also, the New International Version, there's a thing where they mistranslate it of where it says it totally to justify their position on the end times, because like from my reading and this guy with a show on GCN who passed away, but he had made the case that like most of the things in Revelation were about historical events, that it's just using a metaphorical, hyperbolic wording that you can actually find in Ezekiel and some other places as well.
Right.
Because, for instance, like Actually, the size of the hailstorm, the hailstones that come down in Revelation, actually match up with the size of the catapults that are catapult rocks that are described by Josephus, for instance. And yeah,
much of the book of Revelation comes from that. Remember that Sibyl, that ancient prophetess from like the 6th century BC. The Romans revered her.
I didn't know about that until you had pointed that out. Of course, you see that so much of it comes from Daniel in terms of saying about there being some afterlife.
The beast and everything. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, but then...
The beast of Revelation 13 is really a composite of all the four beasts mentioned in Daniel 7.
Yeah, and that whole thing with the beast, too, that's so misunderstood. Like, if you look to the Wikipedia entry for about the beast of Revelation and the whore riding on it, and they'll say, like, oh, the biggest theory is that it's about Rome. But if you look to it, that actually what the harlot is wearing, it's the garb that is worn by the priests, the Levitic priests.
Yeah.
Also that the, like, Jerusalem itself is referred to as, like, a whore in the Old Testament as well.
Yeah.
So I go along with his interpretation that it is actually referring to Jerusalem, of course, which was attacked in 70 AD.
And there was great animosity against the Jewish leaders at that time, of course, because they didn't stand with them against Rome. Yeah.
Yeah, and the whole thing about the star falling from heaven, he was making the case, the two cases, there's actually two stars that come down from heaven. And he's saying the one was Vespasian, who was the Roman emperor there, who first went into Galilee and that and took over that. And then the second star that came down is actually his son Titus, and he's the one who goes and binds Satan, which is actually his interpretation. It's referring to the apostate Jewish leadership. But, of course, you know, being like a Bible-believing Christian, I mean, the whole leadership never had any credibility to begin with, right?
Right,
it's
exactly. Like,
well, the Catholic Church has become apostate since the 1960s, since the Second Vatican Council, which is true according to their original teachings, right? But the whole thing was apostate from the beginning.
Right. Right.
Yeah, so that's all I wanted to say about that, since you're talking about the Bible, but I'll probably call in sometime later this week then to talk about the London 7-7 bombing.
7-7, yeah, sure. Excellent.
Yeah, all right.
All right, man, thanks for the call.
See ya.
Yeah, talk to you later. Bye-bye. All right, guys, that's about it for today. Well, we got a few more minutes. I'll mention a couple more here. There's no end to these. Here's another one along this line, a quote from the great Jesus here. Luke 8:28 says, again, this is another demon talking to Jesus. In fact, essentially, these are parallel quotes, but they're not so parallel. There's details added in, you know, as I said before, each author added their own little sugar and spice. So it's interesting to see the other perspectives of the other gospel authors. Here it has the demon saying, "What have I to do with thee, Jesus, thou Son of God, Most High? I beseech you, torment me not." Again, the idea being that Jesus was into tormenting. They knew he was there to torment or torture. Jesus had the same psychopathic mentality that his Dada had in the Old Testament. Matthew 13:41-42. We read, Son of Man, Jesus is talking here in the third person. He says, the Son of Man shall send forth his angels, talking about on the day he comes back again, and they shall gather out of his kingdom all things that offend and them which do iniquity, and shall cast them into a furnace of fire, you know, the lake of fire. There shall be wailing and gnashing of teeth. In other words, they'll be tormented and they'll be suffering. You know, he's looking forward to, and indeed, his followers today look forward to. Well, they're going to get theirs. They're going to suffer. They're going to be tormented day and night, apparently forever and ever, because that's the popular belief, that the psychopath Yahweh is going to torture people forever and ever and ever and ever and ever, nonstop, 24/7. Some ministers have actually told their congregations that this is going to increase our pleasure in heaven when we see the wicked suffering on and on. It's going to add to our enjoyment. Can you imagine the psychopathic mentality to say something like that. But that's all you get in this damn book. It embraces that. So, of course, they're going to embrace it. Then shall he say also unto them on the left hand, Jesus is talking here, depart from me, ye cursed, into everlasting fire prepared for the devil and his angels. Matthew 25:41. Now, as I pointed out before, this doesn't mean that the fire is going to be everlasting. It means its destruction will be of an everlasting nature. But nevertheless, this is how many Christians interpret it. They're going to be suffering in endless flames forever and ever and ever. That is torture, ladies and gentlemen. And whether you believe Jesus meant it to be never-ending or for an undisclosed duration of time, it doesn't matter. Torture. That's what the lake of fire is going to be all about. That's what Yahweh was all about all through the Old Testament, embracing it, encouraging it, commanding it. Yahweh is for torture. So naturally, his chosen ones are. Yahweh is for world government. So naturally, his chosen ones are. All right, guys, we'll pick up with that tomorrow. See you then. Take care.
Comcast Business is offering 25 megabits per second internet from $69.95 a month. That means if you're still using slow DSL, you have a decision to make. Switch to Comcast Business and get more speed for faster downloads, or stick with slow DSL and watch your business stutter. The choice is yours. Call 800-501-6000 or visit ComcastBusiness.com. Comcast Business. Built for business.
Offer ends 12/31/15. Restrictions apply. 2-year contract and subscription to Comcast Business Voice and Business TV required. Equipment, taxes, and fees extra.